Okay, we are going to begin. Just to make sure you're in the right place, today is Wednesday, April 12th. It's 3 p.m. I know that because I looked at my phone. And this panel is number 3712, entitled The Pursuit of Happiness. I'm Ralph Gregory. I'm chairman of Intelligent Office, a company that was born in Boulder 21 years ago. And we now have 66 locations throughout North America. And we are a proud sponsor of the Conference on World Affairs. I also host a half-an-hour talk show on local TV on Boulder Channel 8 called Deliberate Conversations. And in that show, in half an hour, we explore a single topic with two knowledgeable guests. And you can imagine how target-rich the Conference on World Affairs is for that show. I did two earlier today. I got three tomorrow. A lot of really interesting, capable people. You can find Deliberate Conversations, because I know you're going to want to look it up. You just Google Deliberate Conversations Boulder, and there's about 80 shows up there. And I guarantee you'll find something you like. And it's all designed. We cover everything under the sun. Thank you. Okay, in this session, we're using a note card system for questions. It's not the app. It's going to be actual writing. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and one of the volunteers, Joe, and another person back there, will come and give you a card, and you write your question on the card. It'll come up here, and we'll see what we can do with it. Fair enough? Okay, so this is the pursuit of happiness. And, you know, I actually have been looking at this subject for quite a while, long before this panel. And I found that for eons, psychologists were studying what made people sad. And about 15 or 20 years ago, they started thinking about what made people happy. And there's been a ton of interesting information that's come out about that. So let me introduce our panelists to you today. To my immediate left is Mark Jetvay, and that's a Hungarian name. He heads up a Russian company in Moscow. He lives in Moscow. He's not a Russian, but he lives and works in Moscow. And he has the distinction of working in the coldest and most polluted city in the world. It's not Moscow. It's Norilsk. And it's the only city where pollution was visible from a satellite. And you're here to tell us you survived that. Again, to his immediate left is Claire Daly. She is a musician, and she's from New York. And it's interesting we have two musicians on this panel. That'll come out later about why they're here. Maybe it was accidental, but it's interesting in relationship to this subject. As a red-haired, freckly kid, she did TV commercials in New York. She was a kid actress in commercials for American Express, Volkswagen, and Bell Telephone. To her immediate left is Julie Landsman, another musician, and she's also from New York. I don't know what it is about New York where all those musicians are. I guess you go where the action is. And she's in love with her dog, Maya, and she has hundreds of children throughout the world because she's a teacher, and she stays in touch with them, and they go all around. And then our last guest is Tai Toshiro. Now, Tai Toshiro is an author and a social scientist, and I suspect he is the only person on this panel where this subject really relates to his field of endeavor. CWA is famous for throwing people into subjects that, what? Why am I here? But I think happiness relates to all of us. Even though he's from New York, he has been characterized as an eternal optimist. So, Tai, let's start with you. Have you studied happiness? Have you researched this? And if you have, tell us.
Yeah, it's just kind of the hot topic right now in psychology.
Yeah,
so around 1998, 1999, a fellow at University of Pennsylvania, Martin Seligman, raised about $25 million over the course of a couple months. after he gave a couple lectures about this idea of positive psychology. So I'll give you just a quick background here. Psychologists have spent most of the past 140 years studying how things go wrong. So we study what happens when you're angry or you're depressed or you're anxious or whatever else. We're really good at that, actually. And we're good at getting you less bad, whatever that might be for you. But we know almost nothing about how to take you from zero to positive 5 or positive 10. And oddly enough, just in the past, I guess, 15, 16 years, we started to understand happiness. So I'll tell you a little bit about it, maybe just to lay some groundwork for what we'll talk about today. You know, happiness, it functions. So all emotions function. When you feel angry, that's because something's unfair, and that motivates you to right the wrong. When you feel fearful, you want to avoid something that might be dangerous. When you feel happy, that's a really interesting state, because what would be the evolutionary adaptiveness of feeling happy? And it turns out it's kind of an interesting answer. When you're happy, that means that there's nothing threatening in your environment, which that sounds kind of weird, but there's nothing for you to worry about. And this liberates your mind to just kind of wander around. And what you find in studies is if you induce happiness in research participants, they're significantly more creative than people who are in a neutral mood state or certainly a negative mood state. So there's a lot of thinking right now that positive emotions were helpful for us because they do more than just feel good. They actually help us think in ways that are more complex and more creative, help us be adventurous to try out things we might not try otherwise. The other big finding I think that's come out and that's been debated right now is what can you do about it? So are you stuck with a certain level of happiness? Happiness shows heritability rates around 55 to 60%, which is pretty substantial. But that still means that about 40% is environmental and can be malleable. And the most predominant theory right now is something called the hedonic treadmill, which is a horribly jargony term for you're stuck with your level of happiness that you've been at for your whole life. And it's just kind of a depressing thought sometimes, but it's not that simple, it turns out. And people can make significant changes in their levels of happiness. And I think this is where the social sciences are at right now. We're trying to figure out what factors influence bumps in happiness or decrements in happiness. And they're having some success with that. Some of the answers actually are not pleasing about what can improve happiness. So, for example, if you spend money on things that enhance your physical appearance, this is actually one of the things you can spend money on that will actually improve your happiness across multiple years. And I think it's, you know, it's a really dumb answer because you just like look in the mirror every day and you're like, gosh, I look good, you know? And that somehow gives you a bump. So I'm not going to go on about all the different correlates and all the different predictors. I think it's speculative right now, although there's some answers. Some of it's speculative, and I'd like to hear what the other panelists have to say about
it. Well, I'm going to ask our musicians a question because in the things that I've read about happiness, one of the big elements that leads to happiness is, as Joseph Campbell, that great contemporary philosopher, said, follow your passion. The people who are doing what they love are, that's one of the criteria that makes those folks happy. Now, we assume that musicians, because that is such a difficult business to survive in, and you're surviving, you're musicians, you're doing what you love, so therefore, by extrapolation, musicians are happier than the average. Would that be true?
I'm not so sure that's so true, but I am following my passion. I love what I do. Mm-hmm. I love connecting with other musicians while playing. I cultivate happiness. I don't believe I was born happy, although maybe I was and forgot about it. But over the years of difficulties, I've learned to cultivate happiness. And one of my cultivating arenas is with my students and how I connect with them and how I mentor them and teach them. And another one is playing beautiful music. I had the privilege of working at the Metropolitan Opera for 25 years. I was the solo French horn, so I was accompanying Luciano Pavarotti on a nightly basis.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Did that make you happy?
I have goosebumps just saying it.
Yeah.
The next thing will be tears because I retired in 2010 and I miss it terribly, but I find other ways. I'm in other groups and I work with my students. I played a concert last night here called Music from the Heart. So it's a cultivated state for me. I make an intention to be happy, and I do love what I do.
Claire, you worked with Robert Palmer, Addicted to Love.
Yes, I was on the Addicted to Love tour.
And he, I believe, lived in Jamaica, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was he a happy guy?
Yes, I would say yes.
Yeah.
But I would say about myself, about mm-hmm. being happy, I say reasonably happy in my life because I think anybody who's happy all the time is very scary. And but I think that I'm reasonably happy and I do love my life and I love the music. I love the people in my life primarily. But I think that I have a capacity to be happy. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think whatever field I chose to be in, I think I would find myself happy in. I don't know if that makes sense, but I don't think, oh, we're so special because we're musicians, we get to be happy, and the rest of you have to go to work every day. You know, I don't think it's like that. I mean, I think people have a capacity to be happy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's arguable, and I'm all ears.
Well, you mentioned one of the things that comes out in all the readings that I have is another basic tenet of happiness are people who have connectedness with other people. It's in relationships. And, you know, we all have tribes. It might be, you know, I have a tribe at school or a tribe at work or a tribe at my passion or, my hobby or whatever it is. But relationships is a big part of that. You must have a tribe in the musical world, right?
I have an enormous tribe.
Yes.
And I love it. Me too. Yeah.
I had a company of 1,000 people at the Met. It's pretty overwhelmingly loving.
Has anyone on this panel ever identified an aha moment where you said, oh, that's what makes me happy, and it became sort of a course correction for you? Can you think of anything that occurred in your life that made you think that?
Well, I can add a little bit to that, because I look at happiness as sort of a relative word.
Excuse me. Your mic there.
I look at happiness as a relative word. You know, in order to understand it, you need to understand an opposite. So to understand right, you need to know to be wrong. To up, you need to understand down. And so happiness for me in that aha moment was, I remember on the 31st of March, 2010, my wife Nadia, who's in the audience, gave birth to our twin daughters. And, you know, I knew their names. You know, I knew one name was going to be Lilia, one name was going to be Mira, but you never saw them. And so when I went in, about 6:45, I got called into the birthing room. I walked in and I saw two swaddled children. And the nurse, I went to reach to grab one, and the nurse said, no, you have to take two. And so you have to learn right at this particular point in time.
Oh, boy.
And so the thing is, when you saw it, I had tears in my eyes coming streaming down, because now I understood what the opposite was, because I knew what sadness was, because I knew sadness when my father died when I was 6 years old. Mm. And so now I've got the opposite perspective, that this was pure, blissful happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, connectedness, family, relationships. My line is that the day you become a parent, God goes in and scrambles your DNA, and there's a whole new sheriff in town from that point forward. Those that have children, are your children a source of continuing happiness?
Doesn't apply. Does not apply.
Okay, all right.
I don't have kids.
Anybody down?
Well, we might not have much luck with this question, but I could give you some data about that. And it points out an important division between happiness and meaning. And they're two separable concepts, actually. And so what you find with parents is that parents derive a tremendous amount of meaning, what we call eudaimonic meaning. It's this old Socratic term, right? And that's meaning that comes through struggle and sacrifice. And there's a lot of that in parenting, right? But if you look at their hedonic well-being, so just how pleasurable is the average day, there's what you would expect. There's pretty good dips, actually. And if you're sleeping, what, 3 or 4 hours a night, and you know someone's throwing up on you every day and all these other things, it's not a good recipe for happiness. So it's a divergence. It's a really a convenient divergence to explain this concept of happiness versus meaning and which one people should go for.
Well, a lot too is you know, is happiness the fact of giving something away, or is it happiness of receiving? Mm-hmm. And I think when you have children, you know, you're almost at the point in your life where you're going to give your life away to them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a form of happiness. But you know, at 7 years old, you know, you're still dealing with My Little Pony, Shopkins, and all that other stuff that little children play with, and we haven't really got to the teenage years. So I think in another 4 or 5 years, you come back and ask the question, I might have a completely different answer on happiness.
Well, in this study of connectedness, they reference the fact that starts in your childhood with your parents. You know, where you have this unconditional love. And I would imagine that if you lost a parent at 7, you know, that has a real impact, you know, not only in your life, but in that whole connectedness thing. You know, you get connectedness also through pets, and Julie's an example of that. Your pets become your kids, and we've all seen that. Nature, I mean, in Colorado, hello. I went camping for 25 years out there in wilderness areas, and we used to refer to it as looking for another cathedral, and that's... That was the impact. I mean, you know, go out in some of these areas of Colorado and you just want to know just how insignificant you really are. Go on out there and feel nature. So ideas, information, the spiritual world, they're all involved with connectedness.
Quite honestly, my pursuit of cultivating happiness comes from deep unhappiness.
Really?
Having had a rough childhood, having had a separation in the last few years. Mm-hmm. When you hit bottom, I'm not the type to stay there. I'll fight my way back to the top. I'll find a way, and I'm not a medication kind of gal. So I'll cultivate it through connections with my students, with my family, with my colleagues, with music, with meditation, with energy medicine. I've amassed a huge pool to draw upon to feed my soul, to make me happy. Basically, and I do it every day. I swim every day. Makes me very, very happy.
That works for me, in that I kind of feel like happiness is a choice. I know it sounds like a cliche, and I'm sorry to say
it is.
But I think it's a choice, and I think, you know, that's why I for myself, use the expression, you know, reasonably happy. Like, my happiness, my internal happiness does not rely on the outside circumstances of my life. Like, things can be going horribly wrong, and they do sometimes, and I can essentially still at my core know that I'm okay and that this is something else to get over. Sometimes I can greet it gracefully and sometimes I can't, but that I have a certain level of groundedness and knowing that, you know, that my life is pretty good and that I enjoy it and that we're going to get back to the good stuff. You know, you got to get through this first. And I mean, I heard somebody also say, since I've heard the name of this panel, which was pretty recently, I've been listening to what people talk about or asking people what makes them happy. And, you know, I think the best thing somebody said was just, I can just decide to be happy right now. I can't be happy yesterday, and I can't be happy tomorrow. I just have to go, okay, I'm okay. I'm, you know, I'm here, you know, make the best of whatever's happening, the conditions of my life. My happiness doesn't, and of course there are examples, you know, I mean, you can't have a horrible outside and expect to be happy, but I feel that the, you know, my internal condition can't hinge on the outside events.
I think you make a huge point, because the research says happiness is intentional. You could choose to be happy. Ty, you picked that up in your research?
Yeah, I think you can certainly choose to be happy. It's a lot of effort, You know, and it's really hard to remember.
It's a commitment.
It sure is. Daily, right? It's daily, even hourly, if you're going to do this. And so one of the things I think they found in some of these big studies is that the people who significantly change their happiness do that in a habit-formed kind of way. So they don't even have to think about trying to be happy or doing things that make them happy. It's part of their routine. So maybe they meditate or they go swimming or they have these things built in as part of their life. Now, they're not thinking this is going to make me happy necessarily every day, but just by having that as routine, you greatly increase the chances that you'll have more happy moments in your day. They also find that happy people are luckier than people who are unhappy. And what they find is that happy people just weren't, you know, born that way. They weren't born with good luck. They do small things, small interactions every day that create luck for themselves. That might be saying thank you in a way that whether they make eye contact with somebody. It might be taking the time to really listen to somebody. But they find that this idea of karma can actually work in really predictive ways, and that people who are happy are mindful of these things, and it comes back to them in really positive ways.
Another way to say that is kindness. And that comes back to you. I get so much from being kind. So the act of giving, I get so much.
Mm-hmm. But I just had a question on choice, because you know that old adage, life is a journey, not a destination. Mm-hmm. You know, along this path, you have to make many, many choices. And I suspect what you were just saying, Ty, on people doing things on a daily basis, they had to make that choice at some point in time. You know, they just didn't get up and say, I'm going to go, you know, be this happy runner or happy, you know, swimmer or something. You know, you basically had to make a choice in your life, and you had to sustain that choice. And that's the whole point with that adage, because to me, it's like if you don't make that choice, you just wander in life. Mm-hmm. And if you wander in life, you know, more than not, you're going to be unhappy, because you're going to find many times the opposites are going to occur, where you know you're going to run into trouble. And that's one of the things when I look at this whole theory of happiness, and that's why I raised the point. It's like the relative term, and as you said, Julie, you had to understand happiness because you felt the opposite. You know, and I think those are important distinctions.
Yeah, you can't tell the hills without the valleys.
For sure.
Otherwise, you're on a plateau. It all feels the same, and it's boring. Yeah. And we're all subject to being bored. I actually have a philosophy, a little formula on how to be happy, and it's related to conscious choice. And it's all about low goals. Mm-hmm. Really. Now think about this for a minute. Low expectations, easily achieved to reinforce success. You know, hey, my feet hit the floor this morning. Oh, it's a good day. You know what I mean? I mean, you keep your goals low and you feel successful, and then you're putting that out, and that's what comes back. Isn't that karma?
Well, that sounds like gratitude to me, which I think is a part of the formula. Mm-hmm. Sure, gratitude.
It is a good part of it.
And ironically, when I looked at my Twitter feed this morning on CNN and Twitter, there was an article about happiness. Oh, thank you. And a big surprising ingredient is compassion, mm-hmm. which makes sense, which is, you know, being able to feel empathy outside of yourself and being able to understand what other people are going through, and it can help make me more happy. And that rings true for me, too.
A huge piece that comes out, service to others, mm-hmm. that it isn't just about you. You're doing something for other people, and you derive the benefit of their pleasure.
Very much so, and I find that in my teaching. When I say I have hundreds of children, it's a way to give. It's a way mm-hmm. to feel their successes, but foster them and mentor them and follow them through their careers and set the example and always be there for them. I derive so much pleasure from supporting and giving to my students.
Here's a definition that came from an article, how to find the buried treasures that lead to lasting joy. First off, they say I want to quote this exactly, and I have it here, that, well, I know what they said, that joy is available to anybody, and you can achieve it at any age. And their definition is encapsulated by saying, it isn't money or fame or even good health that leads to enduring joy in adulthood. Joy comes from optimism, low goals, the ability to be with others, connectedness, a feeling of being in control of your life, and a can-do attitude coupled with a want-to-do attitude. Anybody want to respond to that?
Can you say the last part again?
A can-do attitude coupled with a want-to-do attitude. I can do this, mm-hmm. and I want to do it, so I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. You're in control of your life. I think that's part of where they're going with that.
Well, clearly, happiness is not money. You know, I think you know, the empirical data clearly supports the fact that, you know, people making $5 million a year versus people making $100,000 a year, there's no difference in happiness. And so I think if people, you know, use that sense of a measurement, and in one of my earlier panels today, I had the pleasure of sitting in front of half the audience was high school students. And they were asking, you know, what do you do? What should we do to move our career? What should we study? And really the answer was, do what is passion, is what you were saying mm-hmm. earlier. You know, do what you love, because if you do what you love, you'll be happy, you'll be content with your life, and money will follow. So money should not be one of the objects to seek in terms of happiness.
Well, that was the philosophy I always told my kids, that if you do what you love, eventually you're going to learn to do it well, and eventually, you know, you'll probably make a living out of it, but you got to stay with it. And I've seen examples of that all my life. My godson used to tag subways in New York. I mean, you know, graffiti, you know, illegal. And it didn't even stay in school. Now he is literally a world-class designer of his own line of stuff because he always wanted to draw. And that passion, that persistence, 10,000 hours. I can't remember. I think it was Gladwell that wrote the book on 10,000 yep. hours. He became good at it, and people paid him for it. So that whole idea of sticking with your passion really makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I always look to musicians for that because you have such a hard road
to
hoe.
It's far more than 10,000 hours.
Yeah, I know.
Far more. Underestimation.
Well, here's
my best friend says... She's my oldest friend in the world, says, you know, your career is a testament as much to your stubbornness as anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true because I've just been, I was determined to do this and I still am apparently. And, you know, it's really just about keep on keeping on, which makes me happy. I also want to say that I feel like, and this, you'd probably know more about this, there's so many different kinds of happiness, you know, there really are. I mean, you used a couple of terms for them. I didn't know the terms, but, you can be happy, you can be happy if you buy your new house or your thing that you, you know, wanted to get there. That's a kind of happiness, you know. And then there's the kind of happiness when you do something altruistic and you do something that you feel has meaning for someone else or for you or whatever. And you know, there are so many different kinds of happiness. I feel like, you know, it starts to sound like a self-help book sometimes mm-hmm. when we talk about it. But they're really, it's really worth just looking at what different things make you happy. Because maybe, you know, sticking to your art and sticking to your guns about something that you're not making a lot of money does make you happy. But boy, when you get a new car, it makes you happy too. Mm-hmm. You know.
But I think the title when you throw the word pursuit into the title,
right,
it kind of changes the connotation of what you're really saying, because then it makes it like you have to do something.
Right. Okay? Yeah,
I think that relates about what you're just saying, but just
right.
that word.
It also implies that you don't have it because you have
because
to
you
go
have
out
to find
and pursue it.
It. Yeah.
I like the word cultivate.
Cultivate happiness.
Yeah. Here's a question for our musicians. We've heard of the tortured artist, and mm-hmm. so much good music comes out of pain. So the question is, how do musicians find happiness when most music is, in a way, very sad?
Well,
is it?
I don't know. Is it?
I like
plenty
sad.
Of it.
I
is.
Like
yeah,
sad
I love
music.
It too. Oh yeah.
Sad music is a way for my heart to cry. Mm-hmm. It's a way for my soul to have a sound and an expression. better to let it out through my horn than keep it in.
And that's a release.
It's a beautiful opportunity to express sadness.
And certainly for me, the music that reaches me, I start weeping. When something reaches me, I start crying. That's for sure. I've cried on stage. I actually played one time with Aretha Franklin, and at the sound check, she was in a really good mood, and she sang for 45 minutes at the sound check, which that was unusual, and it was the most amazing singing I've heard in my life, probably. It was drop dead amazing, and I was sitting there playing, sobbing while I was playing, because it was just so beautiful. So,
does money relate to happiness?
I feel like you can't say yes or no to that. I mean, it doesn't. You can be very happy without a lot of money, but you need some money to live. You can't really. Mm-hmm. It's if you're worried about how you're going to pay the electric bill, there's some angst right there. I assure you.
I have a theory about that too. I'm not on a panel, but that money to me is the best example of the law of diminishing returns. And what I mean by that is, when you don't have money and you get a little more, there's a lot of bang to it. You know, you get out of college and you get a job, and oh my gosh, I have an apartment of my own, I have my own car, you know, I can go out and have dinner. And that's a lot of bang. And you get raises, but as your money goes up, the bang diminishes until ultimately it flattens out, and then it goes the other way. You get a certain amount of money and it becomes a problem. David Geffen had a great quote. And he said that anyone that thinks money buys happiness has never really made a lot of money.
There's a number, right?
There is a number, actually. Yeah. So in Colorado,
there's a sweet spot.
It would actually be $14 an hour is where you cross some line where you don't have to, if you have a family, you don't have to worry now as much about making ends meet at that point. Now, up to about $75,000-$80,000, that's where it caps out.
That's where you
get this diminishing return. And then, when you get up around the $200,000 range and beyond, you actually start to see adverse outcomes for kids at that point. So kids who come from really wealthy homes are just as likely to end up with mood disorders, anxiety disorders, and substance abuse disorders as kids who come from homes below the poverty line. Which is kind of a fascinating idea that can happen. I think the other thing you see is in cross-cultural data, when you compare countries, there's a line there. And so as long as you're able to meet your basic needs, you know, then you can be pretty happy. And there's a lot of countries that make a lot less money than we do here in the United States. They're a lot happier than we are.
But it's also a point of how much you have to sacrifice to make that money. I think, you know, it's not just the number itself, because, you know, if you're an executive, one of the sessions, like, you know, what keeps us up at night was a question asked. You know, I mean, there's a lot of executives who would be gladly rethink their lives, and I raised a question earlier about this whole point about work. I asked the question. I said, when you're in your deathbed, you know, you're not going to be sitting there asking yourself, I wish I worked longer in life. You know, you're going to want to sit back and say, you know, how is the quality of my life? And it's not purely money. And I think you're right. So you're saying 70, you know, 80,000, et cetera. I mean, you can see that. And, you know, people are not happy because there's so much more pressure. There's so much more responsibilities that you have to take on that you start saying to yourself, is it really worth it, the trouble and hassle?
I don't know if we have an answer for this, but it's a very interesting question. Is there any research with regard to happiness and Down syndrome? This comes from a nurse who notes that all of her Down syndrome patients seem to be chronically happy.
There must be data on that. I don't know it, but
good question.
Very good question.
There have been a couple of questions related to good health and happiness, and drugs. Prescription drugs.
Pursuit of drugs.
Brain chemistry. Brain chemistry. Anybody want to comment on that and how, I mean, we know there are lots of folks with ADD and, you know, I hear a lot of talk about brain chemistry and adjusting brain chemistry.
Well, medication can't make you happy. It can make you less unhappy is what that can do. So it can take you from -7 to, let's say, -2 or 0, which, trust me, is an important thing to do. But it's not never going to take you from 0 to +5 or +7. So that's the limitation of it.
Ty, in your research of happiness, what was the most surprising thing you uncovered or found about it? Anything?
I'll tell you what had the most impact on me that I adopted for my personal life, maybe. The thing that fascinated me was the ordinary magic of happiness. And what I mean by that is that the term I hear people say anecdotally the most, I think, that I know they're the happiest people, is they like to use the term, I love to do the work. And you know, that goes back to this point of your happiness is not coming from external kinds of validation or factors. You just love what you do, right? I hope you've had something like that, where you just loved it so much that just simply having the opportunity to spend 2 or 3 hours doing it made you happy. Or you have friends who don't have to do anything spectacular. You know, they don't have to bring you big balloons or, you know, fancy dinners or anything else. You just could sit there outside here at the UMC and talk for 2 hours, and you just simply enjoy their presence. I think that's had the biggest impact on me, is just how ordinary happiness is.
Is it a steady state of feeling, or is it something that varies based on the situation? Happiness, is it it's a general, or is it related to what happens to you? I think that's the core of the question.
I would agree with the comment that Claire made earlier. If I see people walking around constantly happy, I think there's a problem somewhere going on. And I might be turning the opposite way.
Tick tock, tick tock.
So I think it has to be a state of up and down, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just can't see somebody constantly, you know, happy unless they had a really bad plastic surgeon job and they have a constant smile on their face.
But I heard that makes you feel good about yourself because you did something to look better.
I think it's also a wake-up call. So if you're finding yourself at a low moment and it doesn't feel good, what are the tools that you have to cultivate your own happiness? What are your options? There's a lot of good options out there.
Well, Ty, there's a lot of questions coming up here for you. But I'll just throw them at you. Have you noticed differences in gender, race, class when it comes to happiness?
Yes. Let's take gender. That's an interesting one. So women are a little bit happier than men. Women do better than men in general, I should say. It's just kind of across the board. But it's complicated. So women do better for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is they don't do as many dumb things. The second reason is that their relationships tend to have more depth, so they tend to have more intimacy. This is a big deal right now. The size of our social networks has not changed. That's remained steady across the past few decades. But what has changed is that the majority of people now in the United States say that they have nobody to talk to about a serious problem that they have, which is a big reversal from what we saw just 2 or 3 decades ago. Yeah. So women are more likely to be able to have those conversations on average, and that contributes as well. But there's also some things where there's some struggle as well. Some of the most fascinating data recently I've seen is that just having to live with daily sexism is exhausting. And one of the things you'll find is that women actually are just more tired at the end of the day. And if you correlate that with the number of sexist incidents that they had to tolerate during the course of the day, it's a pretty strong relationship. So although women are happier on average, right, there's a little bit of struggle involved with that and a little bit of work involved with that that can be taxing.
Do you suppose it's because women are generally better communicators?
Yes, they're better. I mean, I'm going to be hard-pressed to say what they're not better at, actually. Yeah. And I'm not joking about that. It's unbelievable across the board how much they maintain an advantage with psychological characteristics and interpersonal characteristics. But, you know, maybe I'll do one more. Race, you do see differences. And once again, it's contextual. So African-Americans, for example, show slightly lower rates of happiness compared to Caucasian Americans. But if you look at the variables that mediate that, it's because of racism or the conditions, the living conditions or whatever else that they might have to deal with in a given day that explains that relationship. So it's not race that's explaining it. It's the conditions that are associated with race that explain it.
Mm-hmm. Here's two questions. I'm going to combine them. Do you think that social media has an effect on happiness? And the other question is, do you believe that our current culture, society, creates more anxiety and depression? So is it harder to be happy today? I mean, is the onslaught of communications making us less happy?
Anybody? I mean, I start to answer. I mean, I think today, you know, we're clearly overloaded with choices. And, you know, and that creates angst in itself. I mean, I think when people are, you know, looking at what they can buy, what they can watch, what they can wear, you know, people struggle, is my hair correct and my shoes right, et cetera. You know, that creates problem. I mean, I don't know. I was just thinking that, just before you asked that question, I was just thinking the same thing in my mind. I was going to ask the panel, what do we think of social media, and does it really add to happiness? And I imagine the communication, the connectedness part is great, but does it also put pressure on people to have to do things and communicate when they really don't want? Is there happiness in privacy? You know, I again, to go back to the session earlier, you know, I was advising some of the high school kids, you know, be careful if you want to look at, you know, what you're going to do in terms of reputational damage, you know, which will come back, or cyberbullying, which we now see is a major problem in a lot of the high school age students. You know, you got to be careful what you put on social media. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if it aids or detracts from it, but clearly you have to be a little more responsible in social media.
I would say that I feel like this thing has become, I'm like a monkey with a morphine button. I'm just like, one more. I wonder, did anybody text me in the last 4 seconds? There is like a sense of connectedness. There is some idea that I'm connected to people, or I'm, you know, there. I don't know. It's a weird dichotomy, because I think, you know, in a way we are all more connected because of these things. And in another way, the personal, I find people are a lot less inclined. Like, I kind of miss the telephone. I kind of miss talking to people. Like, most people don't want to talk on the phone anymore. Mm-hmm. It's text me. Just text me. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm sure there are different answers on that one.
I like social media. I'm very careful with what I put out there. It's usually something business related, or I'm playing a concert, or I'm in Colorado at this conference, or we had a concert 2 nights ago, or pictures of the whole orchestra that I was playing with. Those are the things I'll put out there, but it keeps me very connected to a really large community, mostly French horn players around the world. And I find that a lot of fun.
There's happiness in it. There's
a couple of questions up here that they go to genetics. Are you born happy? Are some folks more predisposed to be happy than others? And can you account for that or overcome it?
I believe I wasn't born happy. I believe I've cultivated it. Mm-hmm. And I know my parents. So mm-hmm. I know where I come from. I know where they come from. Eastern European Jews who are persecuted. This is not a happy bunch. Seriously. Or growing up in the Depression, working so hard and having no money, they struggled really, really mightily. But it gave me a certain fortitude. There's a Yiddish word, koyach. Does anyone know koyach in this room? It's a type of strength where it gives you drive to push through and better yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful thing to have.
Well, you know, and there's evidence to support that some people are just born happier than others. They kind of luck out in the genetic lottery. And that can be great, because if you are born happy, you'll just be happy. You know, you probably know friends like that. You're like, wow, no matter what, you're just happy, aren't you? And there's some of us that just have a hard time doing that, a little more Eeyore-like, maybe. But it is malleable. You know, if you think that there's a bell curve of happiness in the general population, and you think about where you land, so let's say you're a 6 out of 10, well, you have your own bell curve, right? You have some days that are happier than others. You have some years that are better than others. And what you figure out, I think, as you get older and you learn from life and get some wisdom is, what are the things, right, that I can do to make me happy and make it sustainable? And I think that's the lesson that's a little hard to learn sometimes.
But you always hear that comment, is it, you know, and everybody's gotten this question asked to them in their lives, you know, is the glass half empty or half full? You know, and that's sort of a, you know, when you talk about, you know, are you happy, you know, are you through genetics or birth? You know, I think the real answer to that question, from my perspective, and, you know, it's, again, from my own perspective and view of life, is it all depends on where it started. You know, if the glass was pretty low and it's half full, it's pretty good. You know, if it was full and now it's half, well, maybe that's a different part of life, you know. So I just think that it depends on where you start. So I'm not, you know, maybe the data and the research shows that, but it's kind of like cultivated a little bit. I don't think it's something that you can really say that you're born with. You know, I see a lot of babies that are smiling all the time. Does that mean, you know, they're happy and others are crying? Maybe some have rashes and the others don't.
Mm-hmm. But is there a chemical? Is there a chemical component here? I mean, because that's what I meant in the beginning when I said I feel like I have a capacity to be very happy, and I feel like I have the capacity to be happy.
Yeah, actually, the research has advanced to the point now. So genetics, right? Genes just say this is how your brain's going to be structured, and then you can do brain imaging. You can actually see differences in brain structure, and then you can see differences in neurotransmitter release or reuptake. With dopamine or something like that. So there's this really nice pattern where you're like, okay, so there's some heritability, there's some structural differences, and now there's functional differences in how people respond to certain situations. But I would agree that it can certainly be cultivated. And people can certainly get better, and as people get older, people tend to get happier on average.
Mm-hmm. And there's the neuroplasticity of the brain where you do certain practices, absolutely, you're guaranteed to get happier. Yeah. And that's what I ascribe to.
Yeah, but through the research, though, have you had enough study, latitudinal, longitudinal studies, to be able to confirm over time that somebody who is supposedly genetically disposed of being happiness over their life are happy?
Yeah, there are pretty good studies, so about as good as you can get, because you can't randomly assign people to a genetic condition, ethically, I guess. But yeah, short of that, it's pretty compelling, but it's important to say that there's still 40-45% malleability, which is a lot built into there. And the other thing I guess I should mention is that we're only talking about happiness. There's a lot of other good things in different, you know, in fact, happiness is a very U.S. kind of phenomenon. A lot of other cultures will talk about contentment as the greatest emotion to strive for, the greatest state to strive for. It's a very different kind of thing. Or you could be loving. You know, you could be curious. There's all kinds of great things people can have besides happiness, actually, that are worth aspiring to, or that they might, you know, be born with a little bit of predisposition for that.
Go ahead.
When you do the things that you cultivate to cultivate the happiness, is that changing the chemistry of your brain?
Yes,
is that how you do that?
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, there it is.
Repetition.
Yeah,
like a rat going through a maze.
Right.
But it changes. It's changing chemically. It's changing.
Right.
Absolutely.
So if I start training for to run the 1 mile faster than I do now, it's not fast. I would improve, right? And my body would actually change to accommodate the different conditions it's under. And it's much the same analogy for how happiness would work with your neuroplasticity.
So what you're saying is that happiness is a conscious choice, and you can practice yourself into it.
Right, but I'll never run a 4-minute mile, you know. So
yeah, right.
There's limitations to it, but you can move yourself quite a ways.
But you can be content running a 6-minute mile.
I would be very happy to run a 6-minute mile right now.
All right, let's talk about drugs.
Dopamine.
Well, that's it. Do drugs? I mean, this is a state where we legalized marijuana, and appears to make a lot of people happy. Other types of drugs, what is the effect of drugs on happiness? And the question also was about depression, but I believe that's more of a chemical solution, usually depression. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you know, depression would be something where you're negative five, you want to get to zero. So you get an SSRI, like a Prozac or something like that, and that improves your, you know, condition a bit. Sometimes placebos will improve your condition in quite a bit. But there are drugs you can take, certainly, that will make you happier, right? And will make you super happy, some of them. But the question, I guess, is what's your standard for happiness? So is it a 30-minute burst? If that's the case, then yeah, definitely. Will that make me happier across time? I'm not too sure about that. Most of the time, I think the answer is no, although one exception right now that's coming back into vogue a little bit. This data is not conclusive, so don't run with this, but they've been tinkering with LSD again and seeing if that can get people out of a rut sometimes. And, you know, it's experimental. So don't go out, kids.
I'm not going to say that I did ecstasy in the 1970s, but if I did, there might have been a moment. There might have been like ecstatic, you know, moments and stuff, and you know, hallucinogenics and stuff that's mind altering into other dimensions, you know, which there are, and but I think when you use the general term of drugs, a lot of times people are using drugs to escape something in their life, and that catches up. I think that catches up eventually.
They're choosing to alter their reality for some reason. Something about their reality they don't like.
Right.
But can't you not release the same type of dopamine by exercise? It doesn't have to be completely through drugs. I'm sorry, Claire. You know,
I mean, hate that one.
I mean, I you know, when you're running, for example, you know, you feel happy when you're done.
I'm kidding.
I mean, so, you know, you don't always need drugs.
It's like banging your head against the wall. I feel happy when I stop.
That's true.
Many levels of happiness.
All right, here's a good question. We know that news is bad news by definition. You know, they don't lead off with, hey, you know, you woke up this morning, you had a good day, and went to bed. You know, they're going to talk about bad news. So does constant exposure to news make someone unhappy? Or, and conversely to that, would it be helpful if there was a break for news, like you said, okay, I'm not going to listen to the news for a week or a month or something like that? Anybody have any thoughts about
that? I choose not to watch the news.
Yeah.
Can't help but notice a few things, but I choose not to pay attention because it's all bad.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I think the question is actually a really good question because news is not, there is nothing positive on the news. I mean, every time you turn on the television to whatever station you watch the news, it's always negative.
Yeah.
And a constant stream of that, you're going to be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think the world is falling apart.
Yeah.
I mean, if I look out today and, you know, working in Moscow right now, and I follow the stream of dialogue that's going on in the U.S. press today, you know, I should be depressed that I'm going back and forth to Russia all the time with this sort of negativity. But when I'm actually in Moscow, you don't sense the same type of, you know, negativity or you know, animosity towards, say, Americans. You know, maybe on some of the state channels you get it. But I think a constant stream of news will clearly make you depressed.
Do you think the Russian people are happier than the American people?
I don't know if there's a degree of, you know, one's more happier than another, but I can give you kind of an example. You know, I run a lot. I mean, because with the travel, I want to do something as kind of a stress release, so I run. And every time I'm running, whether it's here in Boulder or Florida, New York, or wherever I travel, London, everybody who passes me, I always smile and wave to them, you know, and say hello. I do that in Moscow, and I get the strangest looks, and I actually counted that, you know, for every 10 people I run by, you know, if I get one person who acknowledges me back with a smile and a wave, I did pretty good. But I don't know if that's a measure of whether or not they're happier or not. I think in general they're happy people.
Well, you're putting out good vibes.
I'm putting out good vibes. I try.
Karma. Hey, Ty, in your study of happiness, did you learn how to be more happy?
You know, first I should say that it's not like my original studies I'm citing here. These would be other people's studies that I read a lot. So, you know, this is other data that's out there, but there's a lot of it now. And, you know, people oftentimes ask that about psychologists in general. They're like, you know, has this made you happier, better at certain things? And I don't know that the action has been on happiness. I think that the action has been on gratitude. Because I think in psychology, you get to see a broad range of what people are dealing with. And you get to feel fortunate about what you have and the opportunities you have. So I think that's probably been the biggest effect. And I think that leads to some kind of contentment, maybe some eudaimonic kind of happiness. But I think that's probably been the best part.
But can you relate this or correlate this to, say, the news? I mean, you know, you're sitting there and you said before, it wasn't until Martin Seligman came up with the positive optimism, everything was negative. Right. So, I mean, I would think, you know, if I was a psychiatrist or something, I mean, a constant stream of negativity, just like the constant stream of negativity on the news, you have to be negative. I mean, you have to be depressed. It has to affect you personally. I mean, how do you remove yourself from hearing these stories time and time again, trying to help people that have problems in their lives?
You know, you become an author instead of a psychologist. You know, one thing that happens. There's certain people, though, that can, you know, they're just great at it. And they just have this endless stream of empathy. It's unbelievable. My mother's this way. My mother is a therapist, and she'll see 8 people a day. And she's golden at the end of the day. She's even stronger. So, you know, like, I would be crushed at this point, you know? And I think it's such important work and such good work to do. But when I was doing it in school, I could see maybe 2 or 3 people, and then I had exhausted what I could give at that point. So, you know, I think it's important to choose environments that work for you. And, you know, people can tell you what works for them, and that's great. And sometimes I borrow from people, but ultimately you got to figure out what's your thing that works well for you. You know, I had a friend, Amy. She said, "Ty, you're happiest when you don't know what the hell you're doing." Well, that's a weird thing to say, you know, but it turned out to be true. You know, I like investigating. When I was a kid, I didn't think that would be what I'd love to do as an adult. But, you know, so everyone has something different, and you just got to find what it is for you.
That's a good question. To be happy, should you drop the word should? In other words, does everyone have to be happy? I guess.
No, some people are really happy being unhappy. Okay. I'm not even kidding, really.
Well, that kind of dovetails into love and happiness. And we all know when you're in love, you feel happier. And the CWA is all about young folks. And so I have this article that was written for young folks, Advice for a Happy Life. Got this out of the Wall Street Journal. And it says the transition from college to adult life is treacherous. And so there's 5 points that they recommend. Number 1, consider marrying young. I mean, I think all the research comes out that married people are generally happier than unmarried. True, Ty?
That's true. Yeah. But it's complicated.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's that connectedness and that someone to share life with. He goes on to say, if you wait until your 30s, your marriage is likely to be a merger. If you get married in your 20s, it's likely to be a startup. You will both have memories of your life together. You will have a shared experience. That was his recommendation. Consider marrying early. Second point is learn how to recognize your soulmate. Marry someone with similar tastes and preferences. But if you dislike each other's friends or don't get each other's senses of humor, or especially if you have different ethical impulses, break it off and find someone else. So marriage, is that... a bit of positive in your life, but a dangerous question, right?
How much time do we have?
Yeah, right.
Anybody else want to
say? Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Well, I'm divorced. I'm happily divorced.
Me too.
And I don't know. I've seen those statistics, too. I think we just make up whatever we want about life anyway. So, I don't know. I am single. I was married, and I was in a long relationship after that. And I'm happily single at this time, and I appreciate my autonomy. And when I hear that, obviously I bristle when I hear, you know, that married people are happier. I'm like, really? Really? Like, but maybe it is true, but I know that I've cultivated an acceptance of my life and where it's at now, and I'm good with that. So I'm not the one to answer that question.
Well, he supports that. He says it's absolutely crucial that you really, really like your spouse.
But you know that's true. But the opposite of that, you know, is he promoting that a hookup society is the way to go?
No. He's talking about long-term relationships.
Okay. So when you look at over time, I mean, I don't know how the statistics will bear themselves out, because if you look at the stigma of divorce, you know, your parents in the 40s and 50s, et cetera, you know, they were living together, you know. And maybe today's society, they would have divorced much quicker, but they stuck together, you know. And I'm not sure how the statistics will bear that out to be able to make that assessment on whether or not long-term relationships are happy. I mean, you know, I find that, you know, finding the person that I want to be with and doing things together, you know, it doesn't mean we're always going to be happy. It doesn't mean we're always going to do the same thing. I mean, we're individuals. I think that's the whole thing. You know, we're individuals, and I think it's invariably that, you know, I want somebody who has similar interests, you know, but I also have my own interests that may not correlate or correspond to a person. And I think it sounds to me, when I'm listening to you read that article, it almost sounds like a formula,
right?
You know, and it doesn't feel real,
right?
You know,
that's what I was thinking too.
Yeah.
Well, his third point is, eventually stop fretting about fame and fortune. You arrive at age 40, you enjoy your work, you found your soulmate, you're raising a couple of terrific kids, and recognize that you will probably never become either rich or famous. At that point, it is important to supplant your youthful ambition with mature understanding and acceptance. No.
Yeah.
Now, what
is seriously annoying?
Just me. I would say I made my first record as a leader at 40. So That one really didn't work for me. That one made me unhappy to hear.
So you're interpreting that as like, you know, give up your ambition at 40 or something?
Absolutely.
Yeah, or I mean, but that's the whole thing. You know what? I don't like the whole formulated, you have this, you have the kids, you have this, you have that, you have this, and then you decide that you're going to be okay from now on. Like, I don't know. It just didn't ring real to me at all.
Okay.
But that's just me. Anybody else?
I agree.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to point out, too, that happier people are, married people are happier on average, but that's largely because they were happier before they got married. So the happiest people are actually more likely to get married, and that drives up the average. Okay, because and it's just the tail end. If you're not super happy, don't worry. But if you're super unhappy, then do worry, because that's not attractive. You know, like if you're just like a real down the dumps person all the time, that's unattractive. And so you probably want to move that up a little bit. But happy people, you know, yeah, that's romantically attractive.
Well, here's his next point. Watch Groundhog Day repeatedly. You know the movie Groundhog Day? All right, and he says, for those who are not familiar with it, he has to relive the same day over and over and over until he gets it right. And the movie shows the bumpy, unplanned evolution of Bill Murray of his protagonist, which is Bill Murray, from a jerk to a fully realized human being. A person who has learned to experience deep, lasting, and justified satisfaction with life, even though he has only one day to work with. So that's living in the now, isn't it?
Yeah, that movie to me brings back, you know, the memories of my time in the city you were talking about, Norilsk, because I was there for 6 months, and every day I would wake up, it would be the same minus 45 degrees, minus 50 degrees, three months of darkness, you know, depression around, you know, it reminded me every day that's what we used to joke about. It was Groundhog Day every day. So I guess the end result is either I am a happy person because I survived, you know, and I still am staying in Russia. So I guess I was able strong enough as a person to be able to handle that type of depression. But that was a perfect example in my life of relating to the Groundhog Day movie.
His last point is take religion seriously. And speaking to college students, he says, you know, they believe smart people don't believe in that stuff anymore. You followed the religion of your parents as children, but left religion behind as you were socialized by college. And he suggests that the good way to find religion is to read about contemporary cosmology. The universe isn't only stranger than we knew, it is stranger and vastly more unlikely than we could have imagined. I mean, if you've ever tried to contemplate infinity, you know, I mean, it gets real squirrely.
Was this all in the Wall? Is this from the Wall Street Journal?
It was an article in the Wall Street Journal. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the Saturday
what
essay.
Happened to the Wall Street Journal?
Yeah. But that brings up the idea of meditation. And how about meditation?
Love it. There's one particular kind I appreciate. It's called metta meditation. Does anyone here know about metta meditation? It's called loving kindness, and it's all about your heart. And for me, that brings so much joy and satisfaction and connection to people that you love.
I also support meditation.
Is there anything in, well, I know there's a lot of research on meditation.
Yeah,
it's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to get some of the monks from East Asia, and they bring them into the University of Wisconsin, and they put them in a really stressful situation, and they say, now chill out, and it is instantaneous. You know, all of this meditation over the course of years, they can just shut it down and look totally relaxed. And so that habit, that practice, can really be built up to something powerful.
With some very strong physiological effects, you know, calmness and so forth. I think I already asked that question. How do you avoid early onset grumpiness?
Yeah, but maybe just don't take yourself so seriously. Jesus. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think that's a great question, you know, because it can happen, certainly. And I think I heard some good advice from a comedian. They said, yeah, once you start saying, you know, kids these days or this newfangled, this and that, and once you hear yourself saying those phrases, you should get concerned about yourself. And I think that's true, because I have some friends now, and I'm like, wow, you're getting really curmudgeonly, and you're not really fun to hang out with anymore, you know? Just always. It happened, you can see it across generations, right? You can see across generations that eventually people start to say, kids these days, you know? I love coming to things like this, because last night at dinner, I had three different people set me straight about three different ideas that I was totally wrong about. You know, all of them undergraduate students here. And I think the great thing for the students in the room, if you're an undergraduate or, you know, student here, is that there's few times in your life where you'll be so open-minded and so well-versed in so many different ways of thought. I think it's one of the best times in life. And, you know, as you get older, you want to keep contact with that. You want to keep that eager, open mentality, because society and culture will conspire against you to make you appreciate those things less.
And I would add to this, what I said earlier. I mean, this is, to me, the point of being the opposite, or a relative term. I mean, you know, if you're grumpy or you know grumpy people, you would only know happiness until after you were grumpy. You know, you can't sit there all the time and be happy. You have to understand what the opposite side is. So I just think it's a fact of life that you're going to run across people that, you know, what he says grumpy, or you say grumpy, you know, or sad people, but you're not going to know happiness until you experience that other element of life.
I do my best to not surround myself with grumpy people, but to surround myself with conscious, happy, loving people that I can connect with. I make those choices consciously.
It could be part of your choice to be happy.
Yeah, absolutely. It works.
Here's a question. Does diversity, or perhaps overstimulation, does diversity cause overstimulation and decrease happiness? That might be a social media issue.
It depends.
What sort of diversity?
Well, I'm not sure. Just as diversity. I would assume it's just stimulation. That the, you know, we're all assaulted by communication messages. 2,000 an average a day.
I would say it just depends. It depends what you're being assaulted with. If you're getting a lot of input from things that are exciting to you, it's going to be great. And if you're getting, you know, political news that you feel like you're being, you know, bombarded with, it might not make you feel so great. Or, you know, it just depends, I'd say, to that one.
Yeah, I mean, I always think, like, diversity, yeah, that's a valuable thing by itself, but that's never enough, right? You have to do something with it. And you have to set a context where it can be meaningful and not overwhelming. And that's really, really hard to do. And, you know, so many good ideas come from diversity, and so many good things in life come from diversity, but figuring out how to use that in a way and manage that in a way that's productive, I think that's terribly hard to figure out.
Is the definition, the concept of happiness, in the eyes of the beholder?
Well, could you say that again? That sounded right.
Is the feeling or the concept of happiness in the eyes of the beholder?
Absolutely.
I would say yes.
Absolutely.
How can somebody judge whether you're happy or not? I mean, you can outwardly fake it, but I think it has to be yourself.
There's a couple of questions up here related to money, I think you already answered it. How much money should you be happy with, or you could achieve happiness with $75,000? The understanding being that, you know, if you need food, clothing, and shelter, you can't think about happiness.
Right.
You know, you can't think about anything but that. And you have to get over that subsistent level of living before, you know, you can become discretionary in your thinking. So let's see if I can find one more here. We had a lot on drugs. You know, they wanted to know what drugs would do.
Well, maybe some of you would like to tell us what makes you happy.
Yeah, raise your hand if you got a question. Yes, sir. Yeah, I'll repeat your question.
The key to happiness is good health and a bad memory.
Uh-huh. George Burns said the key to happiness is good health and a bad memory. Yeah.
Someone else, one of his peers said, our parents ruined the first half of our lives and our children ruined the second.
Our parents ruined the first half of our lives and our kids ruined the second half? Oh.
It's almost like it's a never-ending cycle, it sounds like, you know, because you're never going to be satisfied at that point. And if you're never satisfied because you're always striving for something in addition, you know, can you ever be truly happy?
I've got one from Robert Frost. Happiness makes up in height what it lacks in length.
Very interesting. Yes. Uh, At all stages of life, it's important to keep expanding your consciousness, keep increasing your horizons.
But don't really? don't underestimate yourself, because you were very happy last night dancing on that aisles.
Yeah. Oh, that was you dancing
that was
last
it,
night?
Yeah.
Oh, bravo.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Okay, here we go with some diversity question. Are homogeneous societies happier than diverse societies? Ooh. I mean, that goes after multiculturalism or something, doesn't it? Are homogeneous societies happier than diverse societies? Well, let's see. What would be the most homogeneous society you could think of?
Iceland?
Yeah, I was thinking Scandinavian. And but they are, you know, attempting diversity, right, with all of the immigrants they're bringing in.
Anybody on that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's research on this topic. I'm not aware of what the findings are on it, but it's a... You know, it's a good question. So some of the happiest countries are Scandinavian, actually, but it's confounded with wealth, and also healthcare and all kinds of other things that could stabilize happiness.
And vacations, built-in vacations.
Yeah, that's right. But there's also some countries that are very homogeneous that are extraordinarily unhappy as well. So I wish I knew off the top of my head, but I can't think. Yeah.
I thought Denmark had the highest suicide rate or something. They related it to the darkness or something.
I mean, I would relate it to the question of diversity. Is anybody who had a chance to watch the concert last night, I said this earlier today, is look at the musicians. I mean, from last night's performance, I mean, they came from Santo Domingo, Brazil, Syria,
Lebanon,
Lebanon, New York, Toronto,
Dominican Republic.
It was a diverse group of people, and it worked.
Well,
I mean, you were able to make music and make people happy.
I'm happy. One of the things I love living in New York is the multicultural aspect of it. I don't know if that means it would make anybody else happy. It would probably make somebody else uncomfortable, but I feel like I need that in my life. So it's all different. We just make this up as we go along.
One of the best definitions I've heard is happiness is wanting what you have. Find a way.
Appreciating what you have.
Yeah, gratitude.
That's gratitude. Yeah.
Okay, we'll take one more question if it's out there. All right. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were raising your hand. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm the one who wrote down the question about should, and I wake up every morning with should, with capital S. What should I do?
You wake up every morning wondering what should you be doing?
Yeah.
How does that relate to happiness?
Yeah.
Probably makes you very unhappy. I would imagine that would make you very unhappy. Well, the words you choose are extremely potent. What if you were to change the word should to what can? Mm-hmm. What would I like to do?
Or just,
you can't do that. You could try.
Or just walk around the university and look what they did on their branding. Be happy. Be bolder. Be audacious. You know, et cetera. I mean, you know, I agree. It's a word. It's just changing the word. I mean, I think when I walk around and I see these statements, it inspires me.
So I can dare to just say what I want to do instead of what should I
do? Yeah.
I give you permission.
Yes.
Yes. There you go. All right.
Permission granted.
Yes. You are absolved, my daughter. All right. Yes. Is your question about grandkids, did I hear?
No.
About contentedness and happiness, the differentiation.
Contentedness and happiness.
Yeah. You could actually see how they function differently psychologically, but I think philosophically that's actually the more interesting way to think about it. Because happiness, there is this striving, there is this should, I think, sometimes with happiness, where we think we got to get somewhere, right? And I think contentment's more about, this is my situation, and for most of us, there's usually a lot of good things going on. We're lucky in that way, right? And so just be grateful and be mindful of the goodness that we already have in our lives. That's such a different philosophy. I think. And if you look at a lot of the great philosophers across time and across culture, it's much more often about contentment than it is happiness. Mm-hmm. We are happiness crazy in the U.S., and I think we could use a little more balance.
I wrote down before I came here, I just wrote down a couple things, and I said, you know, what is that path to happiness? It says, complain less, appreciate more, talk less, listen more, think less, feel more, frown less, smile more, fear less, love more.
That's excellent advice, and we are unfortunately out of time, and they have to use this room.